Recently, I've spent several days in the Hocken Library poring over documents and photos from the past of St. Peter's Caversham. I'm under pressure to get the second chapter of the parish history finished before the end of the year, and I'm confident of achieving that. The subject I'm focused on right now is about what happened to St. Peter the Less, our mission church in St. Clair. I expect to be reporting back on that in my presentation to you at our dedication Sunday services in 2 Sundays' time. As I read what former parishioners and clergy wrote and about what was written about them and what they did, and look at photographs of them, they have become very real to me, almost like living contemporaries. Some of them, especially my priestly predecessors, were impressive people, and this fills me with a sense that I mustn't let them down. They have left us a good inheritance that must be nurtured and honoured. That is where I want to start on this All Saints Day, as we honour the many anonymous Christians who didn't receive the supreme accolade of officially recognised sainthood, but who were nevertheless pillars of the church and sometimes the unsung heroes of it. We need to keep faith with them. We stand in continuity with them, and we must keep that continuity alive. We're not just the church of the present, responding only to the pressures and urgencies of that. We're also the church of the past, built by it and needing to respect the inheritance it has left us. Take, for instance, the creed that we say Sunday by Sunday. We've just said it. It is not just a time-trapped statement of faith appropriate only to the age in which it was forged. It's a living document, hammered out in the fires of controversy by great gatherings of the church's bishops and theologians, who, in what were called ecumenical councils, that came to vital conclusions about what is essential for us to believe if we are to have a healthy and full-blooded Christian faith. The spirit of truth that guides the church into all truth helped the church to come to these conclusions. It assists also in the work required to elucidate and update these conclusions. The creed isn't perfect. The section on the Holy Spirit, for instance, is a bit light in substance. Just this past week, the Anglican Communion signed an historic agreement with the Oriental Orthodox churches on the procession and work of the Holy Spirit. As a result, the Anglican Church has agreed to stop saying in the Creed that the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Son as well as the Father, the famously controversial filioque clause. We've already stopped doing that at our 10:30 a.m. service, in line with other earlier ecumenical agreements the Anglican Communion has concluded with Orthodox churches. When we take steps like this to help make sure that the tradition of the Church isn't a fossilised dead letter from the past, but a living and vivified work of the Spirit, a connection point with the wisdom of the past that has the power to renew our lives. While we're thinking about the good people of faith that have gone before us, can I mention that one of the things that I'm really looking forward to in the life of the world to come is meeting these folk, having the chance to talk to them, to satisfy my curiosity about what their lives were really like. And of course, I'm not anticipating any language difficulties in doing that. Just as on the day of Pentecost, there was a simultaneous translation service for all those who were in Jerusalem who heard the apostles speaking of the wonders of God in their own languages, so in heaven we won't have trouble communicating with each other. For an historian, this will be a deeply satisfying way to spend eternity. But of course, it won't just be the unsung heroes of the church's past that will be there. Christians yet unborn, the church of the future, will be there also as our conversation partners and company sharers. And that is the other thing I want to say this morning. We need to keep faith with the church of the future, to make sure the decisions we make now about the doctrinal belief of the church, about its ethical standards, about the care of its buildings and its assets are wise, prudential and orthodox. Right belief, right action, right suffering. These are the hallmarks of the faith-filled Christian life, and they keep open the lifelines of the church to the future. While we're talking about the future dimension of Christian life, today's celebration reminds us also of the good things to look forward to and anticipate in the life of the world to come. There's been rather too much emphasis on the here and now dimension of Christian life in the way the faith has often been talked about in recent years. One of the attractive features of the Christian faith is the good news that the best is yet to come when you follow in the way of Jesus. Here, let me mention a few of the things to look forward to in the rollout of heavenly consequences at the end. All the causes and controversies that fill our news bulletins and all the injustices of the past will be decided by the Supreme Judge on the Day of Judgment. All the accumulated mutual wrongs of human life, personal, social, and political, will be rectified. There will be a general sorting out by God, who has the last word on every human life. Justice will be done. Death will be abolished. It is the last enemy, that which blights our hopes and our loving. It must go. Our biological decline and decay will be abolished. Our new spiritual bodies will be lasting. They will have the intriguing feature of expressing our special spiritual character. Our appearance will be a readout of the kind of lives we have lived as faithful Christians. Our identity will be expressed in our appearance. Sexual differentiation will continue. We will continue to be male or female. That, after all, is a key part of who we are in our core identity. But there will be no marriage in heaven. Jesus was very clear about that. That is to say, there will be no exclusive, special, or possessive relationships in heaven. The plaintive cry of the school playground, "Are you my special friend?" will be gone. Thus, we'll be able to relate to the Christians of the past and the future without being excluded by relationship barriers. We will not be able to sin anymore. Since we will be united to Christ, we'll be freed from the temptations and entanglements of the world. That's a big thing. How much confusion and emotional pain has come our way from wrong moral choices? How much emotional energy we've wasted on worrying about whether we've done the right thing, or regret about doing what we knew to be the wrong thing that often turned out to have disastrous consequences. It makes sense that we will not be able to sin anymore, because after all, the shape and content of the fulfilled kingdom could not contradict the Ten Commandments, since they are God's will for the community. Then there is the matter of the new heavens and the new earth. Our planet will be healed of its ecological wounds and catastrophes, the blighting of it that we have inflicted on it. It will be the stage for our fulfilled life as risen spiritual creatures. Matter, the very stuff of our world and the new creation, will have a raised and elevated quality to it. Here I'm quoting from Isaac Dorner. Matter will have exchanged its darkness, hardness, heaviness, immobility and impenetrableness for clearness, radiance, elasticity and transparency. That which the three disciples saw of Jesus and the hilltop around them at the Transfiguration will be the way it will be for us and for our world then. All this we have to look forward to, prompted as we are by the Feast of All Saints, which we celebrate this morning.